For those who were here last night and saw the film, one of the critiques that I have received, you know, you all filled out those little index cards, and one critique that always comes up is, why does it end so abruptly and so sadly with the death of a young teenage girl? And one of the things that I'm trying to push back on is this idea that every time we preach a sermon, we write a book, we write a paper, we have to end happily ever after. We have to tie everything up in a neat bow and say, and God is great and everything's working out for good and yay, hallelujah. But that's not the reality for people who are oppressed. They die. They die in the desert. And when they die, there's no longer any hope. And if I'm going to be in solidarity with the oppressed, how do I sit with the hopelessness of which the majority of the world find themselves in? So, in a very real sense, the situation is hopeless. A hopelessness that many from the margins are embracing. One of the unexamined assumptions of the Christian faith is a theology that is based on esperanza, on hope. All things work for good for those who love God and who are called according to God's purpose, the writer of Romans reminds us. To hope in English is to expect, to await something good. But in Spanish, the word esperanza is derived from the word esperar. To hope in Spanish, esperar means to wait in apprehension for either something good or something evil. You see, the usage of the Spanish word connotes a darker, more complex meaning that implies fear of what is awaited. To wait doesn't always imply a happy ending, especially if the waiting drags on for centuries, as the case of Hebrew slaves in Egypt, or Latinos and Latinas residing in the belly of the empire. If hope is irreducible to the personal, can we instead speak of the eventual hope of the triumph of justice? Does not history lead us towards the ultimate salvation of humanity? I'm not convinced, as was Martin Luther King Jr., that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. I fear that the philosopher Walter Benjamin might have been closer to understanding historical progress or lack thereof when he says, quote, there is no document of civilization which is not at the same time a document of barbarism, end quote. What if how we create history and how we remember our past simply justifies the values and social power of those who get to write the history, literally writing their privileged space into the national epic? What if there is no historical movement leading towards some secular idea based on enlightenment and reason, or such religious idea based on some heavenly paradise? When Benjamin gazes upon Paul Klee's painting, Angelus Novus, the angel of history, he sees, quote, an angel looking as though he is about to move away from something he is fixedly contemplating. His eyes are staring, his mouth is open, his wings are spread, end quote. For Benjamin, who owned this particular print, quote, this is how one pictures the angel of history. His face is turned towards the past, where we perceive a chain of events. He sees one single catastrophe which keeps piling wreckage upon wreckage and holds it in front of his feet, end quote. There is nothing inevitable about the passage of time, no teleology to history, nothing but a game of random chance. What we call history is chaos, with no rhyme or reason, mainly because the events are as unpredictable and as contradictory as humans. One is hard-pressed to notice, as did Hegel, any type of progressive dialectical march toward a better human existence. Modernity has taught us that we, as a species, are moving towards utopia, Rather, we claim capitalism, a rising tide raises our ship, or communism, the eventual withering away of the state. Both of these systems share a salvation history. Hope exists that the future, thanks to God or science or human ingenuity, will be more forward-thinking and more egalitarian than the past. But what if there is no salvation history? What if the pre-modern and the modern views are both wrong? What if the historical dialect that moves history in an upward spiral is but an optimistic construct forced on a very select history? You see, for Benjamin, a storm is blowing from paradise that has caught the Angelus Novus rings with such violence that the angel can no longer close its rings. Quote, "This storm irresistibly propels him into the future to which his back is turned, while the pile of debris before him grows skyward. The storm is what we call progress," end quote. Dark ages of ignorance follow spans of enlightenment, creating at times downward spirals, at other times upward spirals, yet at other times unrelated and unconnected events. In other words, a nonlinear, disjointed, multidimensional passage of time. Michel Foucault argued that history does not exist, as did Hegel, as an internal and necessary unfolding dialectic flow moving in a linear discourse. Rather, what exists is a permanent historical discontinuation. History is not defined through triumphant meta-narratives, but instead is a kaleidoscope comprised of contradictory and complex untold stories and struggles of the very least among us who remain unnamed. History is full of stories of evil vanishing goods, brutality crushing peace. Vanity of vanities, says the teacher, absolute futility, everything is meaningless. Ecclesiastes 1:1. If all this is true, what role, then, is played by religious hope? Hope, as a product of salvation history, either metaphysical or material dialectic, can be optimistically believed if we accept that the arch of history does bend towards justice. But if the past and present are any guides, the existence of such an arc is a faith statement assumed without proof. But hope as a statement of unfounded belief serves a very important middle-class purpose. All too often, hope becomes an excuse not to deal with the reality of injustice. For those struggling to survive, the truth remains that destitution and death awaits the disenfranchised. The reality of reading our daily newspaper is that for far too many who are on the margins of society, there is no hope. In a very real sense, waiting leads to nothingness. But we who are familiar with and grew up in marginalization are used to this. You see, the oppressed of the world occupied the space of Holy Saturday, the day before after Friday's crucifixion and the not yet Easter Sunday of resurrection. This is a space where some faint anticipation of Sunday's good news is easily drowned out by the reality and the consequence of Friday's violence and brutality. It is a space where hopelessness becomes the companion of used and abused people. The virtue or the audacity of hope becomes a class privilege experienced by those protected from the realities of Friday or the opium that is used to numb that same reality until Sunday rolls around. Regardless of the optimism professed, the disenfranchised, their children, and their children's children will more than likely continue to live in an ever-expanding poverty. Sunday seems so far away, waiting, esperando, becomes tiresome. The situation seems hopeless. The hopelessness that I advocate rejects quick and easy fixes that may temporarily soothe the conscience of the privileged, but is no substitute for bringing about a more just and social structure that is not based on the disenfranchisement of the world's abuse. But this hopelessness that I advocate is not disabling. Rather, it is a methodology that propels towards praxis. All too often, the advocacy of hope gets in the way of listening and learning from the oppressed. To sit in the reality of Saturday is to discover the semblance of hope becomes an obstacle when it serves as a mechanism that maintains rather than challenges the prevailing social structures. But this is never an excuse to do nothing. It may be Saturday, but that's no justification to passively wait for Sunday. Walter Benjamin claims, quote, "The Messiah comes not only as a redeemer, but he comes as a subduer of the Antichrist," end quote. History ceases to be a dialectical sequence of events like beads on a rosary, leading humanity to some utopian future. If we are to hope against all hope, then it will be in understanding what Benjamin called the present, the, quote, "time of the now, which is shot through with chips of messianic time. For every second of time has a straight gate through which the Messiah might enter," end quote. You see, Messiahs don't show up once and for all. Instead, the presence of the divine invades the here and now so that we are not alone in the midst of suffering due to oppression. Messianic solidarity with the oppressed in the midst of hopelessness might indeed be the only hope for. Perhaps this is the sad paradox, that hope might be found after it is crucified and then maybe resurrected in the shadows of life. For this is the hopelessness which I think Paul's admonition to imitate Father Abraham, who, quote, "beyond all hope, believed in hope." The disenfranchised have no option but to continue their struggle for justice regardless of the hopeless odds against them. They continue the struggle for survival, if not for themselves, but for their children. But how? Definitely not by ascribing to the ethical paradigms that fail to consider its complicity with empire. If a simulation is not the answer, that is the acceptance of a colonized mind, what then should be the Hispanic's response to hopelessness? In the messiness of life experienced by marginalized communities, the bourgeoisie ethics of white middle-class Americans and their concentrations on virtues becomes problematic. See, virtues, after all, are considered hollow whenever the struggle for justice is absent. Those forced to choose, due to their economic, social, and political marginalization, between an ethically bad choice and an ethically worse choice, appreciate the ambiguity of how ethics is done, from the underside of privilege. Here we can learn much from slave religion. The ethical assumption of an antebellum white America was, and still is, that stealing is immoral. So a slave who steals a chicken from the master's coop is being, by definition, unethical, immoral, and non-virtuous. And yet, the social structures constructed by the master who got to define what is ethical and immoral ignores the fact that he or she stole black bodies for personal gains. Within this oppressive structure, slaves understood that they have a moral responsibility to their families not only to steal from the master, but also to do as little work as possible, even if it meant being stereotyped as shiftless and lazy. What we Latinos and Latinas can learn from our black hermanos and hermanas is that we at times have a moral obligation to engage in ethical praxis defined by those in power as unethical. Moving beyond the mythology that ethics can somehow be arrived at objectively, we are left with a clear realization that whatever we call ethical has more to do with our social location than discovering any particular so-called objective universal truth. Hence, if I am to hope against all hope, then I must turn to my own social location in search for those cultural richness that can serve as a response to my embodied location and my colonized mind. I begin with my mother, recognizing that I am not Hannah's child, but instead I am Milta's child. Milta, may she rest in peace, was an illiterate country girl from the hills of Santa Clara, Cuba, who was sold as a preteen to a family in the city to work as their domestic maid, where she faced both physical and sexual abuse. It was the only way her poverty-ridden family could provide food for themselves. Milta was also a santera who taught me the ways of the African Orishas, specifically the ways of Elegua, who is the trickster. Milta's faith forged a trickster's ethics needed if one wanted to survive the mean streets of New York City. It is from Milta's life experience and the life experience of all the Miltas of the world that has become the foundation of the ethical thoughts of Milta's child. This becomes my Caribbean habitus, and it is from her actions in dealing with her life experience that I advocate what I have coined an ethics para joren. Now, an ethics para joren attempts to situate an effective response within the consequences of colonialism, the oppression of normative social structure, and the pain of domesticated Hispanics. Now, coining a term to describe an ethical practice already occurring among marginalized implies that this methodology of jodiendo already exists. But as an organic intellectual, I simply am reflecting upon this existing praxis for the purpose of theorizing and theologizing. Now, for those of you who are not familiar with the language of the angels, to jorel is a Spanish verb, a word that one should never use in polite conversation. Although it's not the literal translation of a certain four-letter word beginning with the letter F, it is still considered somewhat vulgar because it basically means to screw with. No, it does not mean to screw, but to screw with, an important difference in semantics. The word connotes an individual who purposely is a pain in the rear end, who purposely is causing trouble, who constantly disrupts the established norms, who shouts from the mountaintops what most prefer to be kept silent, who audaciously refuses to stay in his or her place. What is truly profane is not the word that is used. Rather, it is the oppressive, death-dealing conditions under which Hispanics are forced to live. Those who are among the disenfranchised, who stand before the vastness of neoliberalism that offers little hope for radical change in their lifetimes, have few ethical alternatives. Regardless of the good intentions of those who are privileged by society, or the praxis they employ to paternalistically save and rescue Hispanics, the devastating consequences of empire will worsen as the few get wealthier and the many sink deeper into despair and stomach-wrenching poverty. The dominant culture, including progressive ethicists, may be willing to offer charity and to stand in solidarity, but few are willing or able to take a role in dismantling the very global structures designed to privilege them at the expense of the majority of the world's inhabitants. When those who are disenfranchised start to jorel, it literally creates political instability. An ethics that upsets the prevailing social order designed to maintain empire is an ethic that arises from the margins of society who are disillusioned and frustrated with normative Eurocentric values and virtues. While the majority of Euro-American ethicists insist on social order, marginalized communities must call for social disorder, a process achieved by jodiendo. Perhaps it might lead some within the dominant culture to share in the hopelessness of overcoming global forces of neoliberalism. If so, it may be the only way that progress is made. A liberative ethics para jorel can be frightening to those who are accustomed to their power and privilege because hopelessness singles a lack of control. To Hillel refuses to play by the rules established by those who provide a space for orderly dissent that pacify the needs to vent for the marginalized, but is designed not to change the power relationship within existing social structures. If the goal of the politics of Jesus is to bring about change, then it is crucial to go beyond the rules created by the dominant culture, to move beyond what is expected, to push beyond the universalizing experiences. In a very real sense, Jesus was a holy horeron, a holy screwer. Usually when we think of Jesus, images of peace-loving, gentle pacifists come to mind. Ignored is that Jesus was a colonized man, a troublemaker, the bringer of conflict, a disruptor of unity. This is a violent Jesus who makes a whip and forcefully drives out the bankers from the temple, overturning their tables. This is a strategic Jesus who prepares his disciple for what is to come. He instructs that before, when he sent them out without money, belt, bag, or sandals, they lacked nothing. But now they are to bring their money, belt, and their bag, and if they lack a sword, they are to sell their cloak and purchase one. Jesus the pacifist is instructing his followers to buy a sword. So then, how does one create an ethical act that disrupts structures that support and maintain oppression? I suggest the need to Horen, even though the call to Horen, the call to disrupt the social structures that privileges an elite minority segment of society, might very well bring the unwanted consequences of the sword. Subscribing to this indecent ethics by the Horen recognize that the privileging social order exists to legitimize and normalize the privileges of the few at the expense of the many. Now, Horerones are tricksters who lie so that truth can be revealed. When they lie, when they cheat and deceive, they unmask deeper truth obscured by the dominant culture's moralists. These means employed by Horerones in the struggle for liberation may not be considered moral by the dominant culture. Nevertheless, such tricksters are ethical, operating in a realm that moves beyond good and evil, beyond what society defines as right and wrong. Horerones are consummate survivors that serve as exemplars for the disenfranchised in need of surviving the reality colonialism constructed for them. By disrupting the empire's equilibrium to create uncompromising situations for those in power, the Horerones reveal their weakness, expose what they prefer to remain hidden, and remove their artificial mask of superiority. Disruptive, established norms create new situations that provide the marginalized fresh ways of approaching oppression. So, Hori Horeronas provide a moral justification for the employment of deception as a mean of self-preservation for those who face the overwhelming odds that are against surviving. To Horer is not a praxis in which the disenfranchised engage out of vengeance or spite. To Horer is an act of love toward oppressors designed to force them to live up to their rhetoric in the hopes that confronting their complicity with oppressive structures might lead them to their own salvation. Oppressors are also victims of the structures that are designed to privilege them, yet robs them of what it means to be human. To Horer is a nonviolent survival strategy based on love, designed to liberate the abused from the death-dealing social structures that denies them of their humanity, and the abuser of whose own humanity is lost through their complicity with these same structures. If indeed ethics is a second act, a reflection of praxis, then allow me to provide illustrations of what this first act might look like. During the 1950s, in the streets of Chicago, in a Puerto Rican barrio called Lincoln Park, a street gang was formed called the Young Lords. Originally, it was a turf gang that provided protection for Hispanics from the other ethnic gangs. The gangs eventually evolved into a political social movement that fought for and demanded basic human rights and better social services. Now, in New York City, the chapter of the Young Lords launched the East Harlem Garbage Offensive on July 27, 1969. The offensive consisted of sweeping the streets and neatly stacking the garbage bags on the corner for pickup. But the sanitation department historically ignored the accumulation of waste in communities of color and provided poor waste collection services. In response, the Young Lords moved the garbage bags to Third Avenue. There they built a 5-foot-tall barricade across the avenue and set the garbage ablaze. Fighting broke out with the police when they attempted to stop the burning of garbage and arrested those responsible. But in spite of the crackdown by the police, the protesters, due to negative publicity, prompted the city to be faithful to its responsibility of picking up garbage in Spanish Harlem. Change came about by creatively screwing with the system. Soon, the organization focused its energies on other institutions that failed to respond to the needs of the people they were supposed to serve, specifically the church, which has a moral responsibility to protect the poor and disenfranchised communities. So in New York City, La Primera Iglesia Metodista Hispana, the first Hispanic Methodist church located at Lexington Street and 111th Avenue in Spanish Harlem Barrio, was visited by a delegation of the Young Lords requesting to use available space in the church to provide children in the neighborhood with a breakfast program and residents with a clothing drive. Even though the church was empty most of the week, the pastor and the church board refused, referring to the Young Lord delegates as Satanás, Satan's little demons. When the Young Lord delegates attempted to address the congregation on Sunday, December 7, 1969, the church called the police, who showed up in the sanctuary and proceeded to brutally beat up the Young Lords. So, on December 28th, over 100 Young Lord activists and sympathizers successfully took possession of the church, sealing the doors with 6-inch railroad spikes and raising a wooden sign with red letters renaming the church as La Iglesia de la Gente, the Church of the People, under the premise that the first responsibility of the church is to the people. Now, during the 11 days of occupation, over 3,000 people came to church. The People's Church briefly developed child care for working parents, established breakfast programs for children, conducted clothing drives, provided opportunity for political education, fought police brutality, and made concerted investments in the social services like health care. By January 7, 1970, the police retook the church, arresting the 105 occupiers, at which time the church ceased being the People's Church. Now, unfortunately, due to FBI infiltration of the organization and political infighting, the Young Lords disintegrated in the early 1970s. But for a brief moment in time, an indigenous Hispanic-based ethical methodology of Jodiendos was in flesh. The Young Lords were concerned that institution, specifically religious, which play a vital role in the lives of Hispanics, were abdicating the Christian mission they were professing to believe. Playing the role of trickster, they demonstrated that those who claim to perform the task of ensuring the people's welfare have violated their social contract. In effect, by implementing the services they should have been taking place, these institutions were shamed for failing to live up to their supposed mission. Now, although the Young Lords were not a Christian organization, nor were they particularly a pacifist ideology, it did demonstrate, more so than most Christian theologians and ethicists, that the implementation of the gospel is a subversive and radical venture that literally disrupts, undermines, and challenges those who have become complicit with the status quo of oppressive structures. By their jodiendo in the streets, the members of the Young Lords modeled what a Latino ethical paradigm should look like. Now, obviously, this ethical term para joder did not exist when these events unfolded, and I'm well aware that I am imposing the term I am coining on historical events. Nevertheless, I would argue that these events were led by individuals who refused to follow the rules that usually ensure their people's subjugation to the dominant culture. We have evolved into a society that requires obtaining a permit to picket the police department from the police department for the police brutality of the police department. We have the freedom to protest as long as it does not disrupt the social equilibrium demanded by those privileged with power and the social equilibrium morally justified by those Euro-American ethicists who benefit from those same structures of power. I will argue that the best way for the powerless, the marginalized, the disenfranchised, and the dispossessed to radically counter the prevailing status quo is to joder. Although it may be tempting to also end this talk with a note of hope, the fact remains that dispossession, disenfranchisement, destitution, and death awaits too many who are on the margins of society. The reality of reading our newspapers is that for far too many who are on the margins, there is no hope. Billions are born into poverty and die to its consequences so that you and I can enjoy the privileges of first world status. The marginalized offer up their lives as living sacrifices so that you and I can live and live well. If a conversation is asked for, it will be for those of us with power and privilege to learn how to stand in solidarity with the hopelessness of the marginalized of the world and follow their lead in jodiendo. Then maybe we might discover and secure our own salvation. Thank you for your time. I did want to